to the verb, even as the genitive is especially allied with the substantive. It relates primarily to action and indicates the direction, extent, or end of action. The accusative signifies that the object referred to is considered as the point toward which something is proceeding, that it is the end of the action or motion described, or the space traversed in such a motion or direction. So you can see in all of those renderings, it's related to verbal action, and especially motion. So the root meaning of the accusative really embraces three ideas: the end or direction or extent of motion or action. The end or direction or extent of motion or action. But either of these ideas is employed to indicate the limit of the action, and hence we may define the root meaning of the accusative as limitation. So it's limitation in this sense, limitation as to the end or direction or extent of the motion or action that's taking place. If one say, the ho anthropos epempsen, the man sent, the act of sending is left without a boundary and has no definite meaning. But to say, ho anthropos epempse ton doulon, the man sent the servant, immediately limits the action by the specification of its object. Or to say, ho anthropos eilthen ten choron, the man went to the country, limits the motion by specifying its destination. Likewise, to say, ho anthropos eporiueto makran hodon, the man traveled a long journey, limits the action by indicating its extent. So, in either case, limitation appears as the ultimate function. This basal function is more or less evident in the various uses of the accusative. So this is a basic observation that we're talking about limitation of some sort when we're talking about the accusative, and we're generally dealing with action or direction or motion and so forth in our verbs. Now, of course, this is a general statement because, as we'll see in some of these other subcategories, it's not quite as obvious as that, but the idea of limitation, I think, is a pretty good, simple description of what accusative is doing. So, in the subcategories of the accusative, was there any question on that first? Yes, Greg?
I was just kind of wondering, getting an understanding of an adverbial phrase, it seems like that's affecting the verb,
right? Well, keep that in mind, because your second category here, the adverbial accusative, is going to kind of cover that. We'll see that it's very appropriate to have what we call an adverbial accusative, or accusative used in adverbial senses, because of this idea. See, when you think about an adverb, what does an adverb do? It modifies the verb. At least that's one of the main things that it does. And since the accusative is related to the verbal action, then it's going to be very appropriate to see that. So keep that in mind, and that's one of the main categories that we'll be dealing with here. Okay, anyone else? Okay, let's look at the first subcategory, the accusative of direct object. That's the one you're already familiar with. The idea of limitation is most clearly seen when a noun receives the action expressed by a transitive verb. Transitive, of course, meaning one that takes an object. Blass calls this use the complement of transitive verbs. Of course, he's defining, we've talked about object complements before. And so he's taking that terminology of complement a step further and calling the thing we call the direct object the complement of transitive verbs. Kind of interesting terminology, but I think we'll just stick with the direct object terminology. It refers to the action of the verb to some object which is necessary to the completion of its meaning. Of course, any number of examples occur in the New Testament, so you can pick almost anything here. Aletheon, lego, I speak truth. Aletheon, accusative case, direct object of the verb lego, I speak. Okay, it must be kept in mind in determining the accusative of direct objects in Greek that many verbs in English, which in English are intransitive, are treated as transitive in Greek. Such verbs are those which mean to speak well or ill of one, to abstain, to have mercy, etc. Occasionally we find such verbs connecting their object by means of a preposition, just as our own idiom. Well, he's just bringing up the point that, and actually another point can be made here too on the converse of this. He's just saying that there are some verbs in English which are intransitive, but that have an object in Greek. But in English, we use a prepositional phrase or something, to this or that. But we set up a little different structure, and the Greek will just have a direct object there. And in English, we may be forced to translate it with a prepositional phrase or something of that nature. The converse is true, too, in a certain sense. There are verbs in Greek which take objects, say, in the genitive or dative. In other words, in English, we have our verb takes a direct object. In Greek, and takes it, what we normally expect a direct object. In Greek, there may be verbs that take a genitive in that position of an object or dative, and we've seen that before because of the meaning of the verb. So we need to keep in mind that it may not be a one-to-one correspondence, English to Greek, in this respect. Okay. And then the second category is the adverbial accusative. Sometimes in performing its limiting function, the accusative does not directly complement the verb, but qualifies it in an indirect way. It is an accusative employed to denote a material object only in an immediate or remote way. In other words, instead of having this thing in the accusative be the recipient of the action, that's the way you normally define a direct object, is the one who receives the action of a transitive verb, and of course, assuming, of course, the verb's in the active voice. If it's receiving the action in that way, then you can normally see the accusative sense, but there are accusatives that are used that are not directly receiving the action, but they are limiting the action in a certain way, in a remote way. So it limits by indicating a fact indirectly related to the action rather than an object directly affected by the action. So instead of having the accusative be an object that's affected directly by the action, receiving the action, as it were, normally, it's some fact or piece of information that's related to the action. And so it's still adverbial. Many words came to be so frequently employed in this indirect use of the accusative that they became essentially adverbs, some disappearing entirely from use in other cases and becoming exclusively adverbs. For example, proteron, playstone, malon, skedon, all of those words apparently don't occur in any other cases, just in the accusative. And so we would just categorize them as adverbs. They're undeclined, you know. But they've got these accusative endings. Yes?
Testimon has a big satisfying as, well, maybe that was the adjective, but for neuters, that for wasn't there a classification of adjectives or was it adverbs that either have one ending or it could have an ending?
Oh, yes. I think you were probably thinking of the comparatives and so forth, and I think there is a relationship in some of those between these two as far as the root of those things. And then, of course, in that chapter on adverbs, where we made our common way of making an adverb was to take the genitive plural and make it undeclinable. So there's some similarities there, but these. There may have been when we had the chapter on adverbs, I think they broke it down into several types of adverb endings, and this may have been one of those. You can double check that. I don't have Getches with me here, but maybe if you've got it, you can look and see. I think he did put some different categories of adverbs, and that may be one of those. I don't know if he mentioned anything about it being an accusative ending, though. Okay, in this category of adverbial accusative, we've got three subcategories of measure. The adverbial accusative may be used in three senses, of accusative of measure, and then we've got apespaste, ap auton, hose, lithon, bolein. He was separated from them about a stone's throw. Okay, your accusative here is bolein, and that's accusative form of throw. It's a noun built from the verb to throw. So a stone's throw, the throw of a stone, in other words, a throw of a stone, lithu is genitive modifying bolein. And this is just an accusative, an adverbial accusative, because obviously the stone's throw is not receiving the action. Separation isn't really an action per se anyway that something's going to receive. Maybe in a real kind of a metaphorical sense or something, you can see that, but it is limiting that action. It's telling you the measure of the separation. It's telling you how much separation there is, and so it's in a more remote way associated with the action. It's adverbial. It's modifying that action, as it were, but it's not really the recipient of the action in the normal way we think of it. So to this, there's several of examples that are mentioned here. To this adverbial accusative of measure belongs the accusative of the time during which. Sometimes the accusative is used to indicate point of time, much as the locative, but with a sense of duration or extension not possible for the locative. Now, this is an interesting statement. whoever deals with this, if you want, if somebody's working on this locative idea, perhaps you might put this one to the test. He's claiming here that when the accusative is used to indicate a point of time, it is part of a continuous period implied by the context. This implication is not possible for the locative. So he's saying that the idea of duration or extension is seen with the accusative and is not seen with the locative. So that's a hypothesis that might be worthy of test. He gives a few examples here you can start to look at, perhaps. But if anybody's doing a study on the case functions there, especially this particular use in the sense of adverbial usage and so forth, that might be worthy of a look to see if you're, every time you find the accusative, if you find that sense of duration or extension or something there. And, you know, just looking at the examples that I've seen, it certainly seems to fit, but one would want to search that more thoroughly. Okay, then of manner, doreon elabate, doreon dote, doreon dote. Freely you have received, freely give. Okay, this freely, doreon, is an accusative case form, so it's being translated as an adverb. In other words, something like, it's probably coming from the word to give, a gift or something of that nature, so it's describing the action and the manner of the action under the image of a noun in the accusative case. So, in a sense, you're talking about giving to the extent of receiving to the extent of of a gift or of freedom and so forth. It's a little bit. This is almost adverbial. You almost have to just take it as an adverb, and that's it's very similar to what we see above there.
The gift we receive.
I think
free,
so.
Free gift.
Free gift is something that's been bestowed by grace and unmerited favor, that type of thing. No cost. It's not a wage.
So you could almost say you have received a free gift. Give a free gift. Maybe in a sense.
Yeah, that's kind of the sense. It's not you have received a you have received a free gift. Yeah, give a free gift. If you take it that way, that fits the position of an object pretty well. That probably would work. You might check that and see if if that noun is used frequently. In other words, what I'd be interested in is to see if this noun is used real frequently, just as is, as opposed to seeing this thing used in an adjectival sense or adverbial sense all the time. If it's the same noun, then I think you've got a good case.
In the back of this, they classify Dorian as an adverb.
Okay.
Whereas a Doria is gift.
Okay. Okay, so they classify it as an adverb. That's what I suspected. It's probably used a lot that way. But you could still analyze that as a noun, as a direct object, if it's Doria. Is it hey Doria? Is it feminine?
Feminine, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, this would be precisely the accusative case form that you'd expect for that, so that's probably what's happened. It's just been used a lot that way, and therefore they give it the status of an adverb. But if it's listed there, it's probably used in other cases too, so it wouldn't be like the ones up above, per se. But that's a good way to think of it, that you've received a gift, give a gift, give a free gift. Okay, and then of reference, adverbial accusative of reference. Hetis pola ekopiasan emas, who labored for you with reference to many things. Okay, this pola is your accusative that he's focusing on here. So the hetis who, and then labored ekopiasan emas for you. And then pola with reference to many things. Pola is just, now this of course could be nominative as well, but nominative isn't usually used in this type of an instance. So you take this as an accusative plural neuter and with reference to many things. So that's limiting. In other words, it's limiting the action of laboring with reference to many things. And that's very much like that dative idea. But the idea is a limitation. It's not quite the same thing, of course, but it's along the same category, and it might be a little bit harder to make a distinction. So the accusative is used with the infinitive is not properly the subject of the infinitive, but as an accusative of reference used to describe the person connected with the action. Remember our accusative with the infinitive. I think if you look at a lot of examples of that, you can see it's kind of got this idea of limitation. The infinitive action, you see, is not really being specified as precisely. The fact that you use an infinitive is putting it in a more general category than the regular form of the verb. And the way to think of this, perhaps, to find some continuity in the usage, is to think of this accusative as an accusative of reference that's describing the person connected with the action. And there's a sense there that that's probably as good wording as it can be placed on it. But I've noticed this many times in looking at those accusative and infinitives. After a while, it makes sense to see them in the accusative. Because of the fact that you're specifying and limiting the action that's itself being treated in a more abstract way. And the whole abstractness of the construction is the reason perhaps for this accusative use. It's all right to go ahead and think of it as the subject of the infinitive if it's easier for you, but there's a reason why it's in the accusative case, because the whole thing is being treated and looked at it from a distance, as it were, rather than you're not right in there in a narrative talking about this action happening to that person and so forth, so much as looking at the limitation of the action from another perspective. Okay, he does mention here at the top of the next page that the adverbial accusative is used widely in the papyri. All right, then thirdly, the cognate accusative. When an accusative of the direct object contains the same idea signified by the verb, it is called a cognate accusative. So what we're seeing here is nothing really grammatically unusual or different than what we've seen before. You could just analyze this as a subcategory of the direct object. But this is when you have a direct object that's built from the same root word as the verb itself. And so here the limits set by the accusative are coextensive with the significance of the verb, the use being for emphasis. So here we have ton kalon agona egonismai. Now you get this egonismai from agonizomai, again you get this the verb, and then you've got agona as the, it's built from the same root, so you fight the fight, as it were. And this is done for emphasis. You know, you get a stronger emphasis there when you use the verb. You could just say, I have fought well. But to say, I fought the good fight is more emphatic, very definitely, even in English. And for the Hebrew students, you remember things like, I dreamed a dream. You know, same kind of an idea there, where you get a more emphatic thing by using the noun and the verb together. Okay. So cognate accusative. Cognate means it's the same root word that you're talking about. So whenever you're seeing your direct object built on the same root as the verb, you have a cognate accusative situation. Although you would diagram this, of course, just like you would a direct object, the verb and then the direct object, as far as the grammar is concerned. Okay, any observations, questions there? Double accusative, that's one we've already looked at. Some verbs require more than one object to complete their meaning. Such are those which take a personal and impersonal object, for example, a verb to teach, ekenos humas didaxe panta, he will teach you all things. Okay, subject, ekenos, or that one, didaxe, verb, humas, one of the objects, and panta, the other object. One object is telling you who you're teaching, who's receiving the action of being taught, and the other object is telling you what is being taught, the impersonal one, and that's also receiving the action of being taught to someone. So we've already examined this construction before. I don't know if there's any need to really belabor it now. Then there's a second category, and this is what in Getch's chapter was referred to as the object complement. Here he calls it a direct and predicate object. And so he's got a little different terminology for it. But this predicate object is what we earlier knew as the object complement. The object complement. And so, uketi lego humas doulos, I no longer do I call you servants. Again, with certain types of verbs, this kind of construction is seen. To call someone, something, that type of thing. And it could be even considered a special case of the previous, except very often here, the major difference is that there may be personal reference in both of the terms. You know, what was it, the Kipper called the captain a fool, or whatever it was that made call the captain a fool. Fool is a personal reference, and so is captain. So, and that's generally, you know, one of the, at least one of the lines of distinction in this kind of thing. Okay. I don't know if I want to go through the rest of this point here. Okay, let's move up to point five, the accusative absolute. This is a very interesting one that is debatable. Sometimes an accusative, with or without a participle, is set off in a sort of explanatory way, grammatically independent of the rest of the sentence. Now remember your genitive absolute construction, which was kind of that way. In the genitive absolute, we always had a participle, and we had a genitive phrase that was kind of set off from the rest of the sentence grammatically. It wasn't grammatically tied to the rest of the sentence. And so that terminology is being borrowed, that absolute terminology is being borrowed here and applied to the accusative. It says, this use is very rare in the New Testament. Robertson gives Acts 26:3 as the clearest example. There are a few other possible instances. So this is not one that's being set forth with any great degree of confidence, to say the least. You know, stain on tasse, since thou art expert. Okay, what we're finding here, sa, of course, accusative, onta, accusative form of the participle, gnostein, accusative. So everything's in the accusative, and it's apparently set apart from, grammatically, from the rest of the sentence and the paragraph structure that it's found in. And so it's giving an piece of information that's relevant, but it's grammatically not directly connected to everything else. So this is what he's alleging is an accusative absolute. Now he gives a note here of expressing doubt himself in this. One cannot be positive that any of these constructions is an accusative absolute. Each of them may be otherwise explained. Weiner regards Acts 26:3 as an anakaluthon, a construction of frequent occurrence in the New Testament. Now he doesn't tell you what an anakaluthon is here, but what that is, the word means lacking sequence, having no sequence. That's the basic meaning of the word anakaluthon. And if you're interested in this, Robertson, pages 435 to 440, gives a discussion of this. Robertson, pages 435 to 440. Basically, anakaluthon, that's a term you'll find grammatical. You'll see it in Hebrew and so forth, grammars as well. It's referring to one construction that's not grammatically related to the other, some other in the sentence. In other words, it's as if the sentence is not finished before starting another. It's almost as though the person had an abrupt change of thought pattern as he was speaking. And he started to say something, as it were, and then suddenly switched. And sometimes that's done on purpose for emphasis. It's a literary device to express emphasis and that type of thing. So he's saying, since thou art expert, is an anakaluthon. It's just thrown in here as not grammatically related to the rest of the sentence. And then we start resuming another thought. Yes?
Well, that would be legitimate, except unless he's saying... See, the way I get what you're saying is, what he's calling that anakaluthon is, then it is related then to what Paul did. But then if this is not related to what Paul did, then it can't really be.
Okay. The point is, it related to what follows or what went before, is the point is that it's not grammatically related. Obviously, it's going to be meaning related. Otherwise, you're looking at a person who's not coherent. You know, in other words, if assuming we're talking about coherent speech, and that the words that are there are intended to be there and intended to transmit meaning, which of course I think we can safely assume in the scriptures, then the use of such a device would be to grammatically disjoin it from the rest, so that you get some sort of a pause in thought. Or an abrupt interjection in your thought pattern, so forth, that may be done on purpose. So that's what he's saying here.
Then with the same thing.
What's that?
Don't you end up with this?
Well, yes, you do. In other words, to say that this is not grammatically related, and then to call the accusative absolute something that's not grammatically related, what's the difference? The only thing is that anakaluthon is a more general term that is not restricted only to accusatives. Anakaluthon is a device that you'll see with nominatives or with, you know, other cases and so forth. Yeah. Well, perhaps a genitive could be considered in that category too, genitive absolute.
Revelation 12:5. We don't understand.
Well,
like that, because it's kind of a, it's
Yeah, that may, I don't know how a grammarian would, you know, if he would break it down that far and say even within a single word that doesn't seem to be in place. Usually it's a phrase or a part of a sentence or something, that at least that's the way I've seen it described. But it might be interesting to check and see it in Robertson's section there and see if he includes some things like this, where you get down to an actual word. I'm not sure if they want to define it that way. Of course, it all depends on how they're defining it. This is a game of definitions, I suppose. Well, see, in other words, some people call it this one accusative absolute, and maybe call something else and have another name for all the other ones, and somebody else comes along and says it's all anakaluthon.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like, I mean, if you wanted to break it down,
that
part, you're justifying bad grammar.
Yeah, right. Yeah, find a way.
If it, then, you know, if I was comfort, then it's not bad grammar.
Right, okay. Yeah, you can.
Stuff like that, too.
Yeah. In English, we do. Yeah. And especially when you're doing anything, writing anything that has some emotional impact to it, it's not uncommon to do things on purpose, you know, to paint pictures with words and so forth, that type of thing. And since the scripture is often portrayed that way, it's not unusual to find things like this. You really get an impact from it. And like we said, this is not really a grammatical violation, really. It's just that it's not grammatically related to the rest of the sentence. And it maybe defies description in terms of a simple subject-verb-object type of construction. Although here, since thou art expert, we could certainly consider thou sat as the subject and onta and gnostein, you know, as a subject-verb-object, although the problem is they're all in the accusative case. And so that's kind of setting this thing in an interesting mode. And it puts it in a kind of an adverbial relationship to the rest of what's going on. I mean, this has certainly got some relationship to what's going on, to say, since thou art expert. Maybe somebody ought to look up that verse and see what the rest of the context
is. Verse 2 says, concerning all the things of which I am accused by the Jews, King Agrippa, mm-hmm. count myself happy that it is before you I am to make my defense this day. And then comes verse 3, mm-hmm. especially as you are an expert on all the customs as well as the controversies among the Jews.
Okay. Yeah, especially as you are an expert. Okay. Yeah, in a sense, you can almost say, you know, you being an expert on all these things, you know, just kind of throwing that thought out and that concept out, you being an expert, therefore, that's the idea. And, yeah.
It's almost as though, well, the way we would possibly see it today would be something set off in the middle of a sentence by dashes.
Yes, a you know, you can think of it that way, dashes, or maybe not even a parentheses is a little bit, you know, but it seems to be a little bit more integral than parentheses. It's not optional, but there's a break there on both sides, and it's being set off like that. Very much like the genitive absolute. Very much like the genitive absolute. It's almost a circumstantial type of thing, since you're an expert and so forth. So it's a similar kind of an idea. And if you can accept genitive absolute, you shouldn't have too much trouble accepting this. Whether you call this an accusative absolute, you know, the problem there is that there's not enough examples of it to set up a whole category necessarily. Or call it anakaluthon is no problem. And anakaluthon may be a little bit, you know, at least related to that, because that'll give you more of a general category that you can apply not only to Greek but also to Hebrew and so forth. Hebrew students can apply that as well. Okay. He gives some other statements that other people make on this too. I'll read a little bit further. He expresses doubt about there being any instance of the accusative absolute in the New Testament, giving it as his opinion that on close examination the grammatical reason for the accusative can be discovered in the structure of the sentence. And so he feels he can. Others feel they can't discover the grammatical reason for it. So they're divided on opinion there. It is used in classical Greek, and the inscriptions and the inscriptions, but is very doubtful in the papyri. Webster quite pertinently defines this usage as the accusative in apposition to the whole sentence. So just putting that in apposition to everything else, that's kind of the way he looks at it. And a positive use of the accusative, it undoubtedly is. Okay, so those are some range of opinions on the subject.
That's just another way of defining it, isn't it? Because you could say the same thing about genitive
adjectives. Yeah, you can put that, call that in apposition to the rest of the sentence, too. Because especially when you're dealing with an adverbial sense. In other words, the meat of the sentence is the action that's going on. And so what we're saying, in effect, is that this genitive, say, talking about the accusative absolute now, is something that's stuck out here in apposition to this verbal idea, and you know, you get the same kind of an idea. You know, you can think, you know, another one can think of every adjective as a word in apposition to the noun that it's modifying. So, you know, it kind of depends on how you're going to draw your lines of definition. And again, we're coming to grips with the fact that different grammarians are going to define things different ways, but that doesn't really serve as a basis to break fellowship with one another, because you follow this guy and this guy. The point is, you might define it a little bit differently. You might choose a different terminology to group it in. But if you're agreeing as far as what the thing means, that's the important thing. Okay, then the last category here is the accusative with oaths. In the New Testament, horkizo, I adjure, is regularly followed by two accusatives. So horkizo se ton se on, me basanises. I adjure thee by God, torment me not. Okay, this first phrase, horkizo se ton se on. You've got se in the accusative, you've got ton se on in the accusative. So you've got a double accusative, and this really could be considered a double accusative. In fact, he says that this is really a double accusative, as placed by Robertson in that class, but the peculiarity of the idiom justifies distinctive treatment. So he says this is just so peculiar, we're going to put this in here. It's a separate category, but so, you know, a lot of others would just categorize it as the other. It's just because I suppose the other one's a little easier to see. We don't normally think of it. I adjure thee by God. We wouldn't normally, you know, the thought in Greek is I adjure thee, God, you know, and we wouldn't think of it that way. We put by or something in there, but the way that their verb is constructed, it's taking two accusatives, and so we're almost having to translate it with a different construction in English to get the idea. You can see the idea of limitation in both cases, though. I adjure thee with reference to God, or, you know, limited by God's, you know, God, the authority that God has given, etc., for me to adjure. That's the limitation of it. Okay, great.
I wondered if someone might take that as in saying that Jesus was God. And I don't think you'd have that right. That would be the right form to say that. Though.
Oh, that Jesus himself was God to state this. You know, for the demon to say this.
I adjure thee with God.
Yeah, you would have to either, you probably have to have it vocative here to do that. See, vocative would be addressed. In other words, if you're taking the I adjure thee, God, that would be a vocative. You'd have God in the vocative. And either Tha or Thaos.
Especially since the demon said
Jesus
son of the Most High God.
Right, just before that, right. And it's interesting that that the demon is appealing to the authority of God, too. Quite an interesting twist. Give you some theological food for thought. Okay, yes.
I was reading a classical book, Greek book, last night in the undergrad library. He was talking about the genitive and applicative, and he said that, right here, back when the original mother comes in.
Yes.
But he said that, you said in the classical Greek, there is a remnant of the applicative case and form in what is a. That's the one new ending. He gave an example of like Athens, which means from Athens.
Okay.
He lifted about four or five words that had an E and ending that had that separation idea of a front.
That's probably where they're getting a lot of this from, is to see if there were some distinctive ending systems. I saw some arguments too for a separate instrumental ending too in the older classical. But there are some debates on it too. Another grammarian comes along and says that's not what it is at all, you know. And you know, you don't have enough examples to really build a solid case. But that's what they're looking at, and that's why they're looking so much at Sanskrit and some of these other languages and trying to get comparisons and seem to line up one thing to another. And there may be some justification for a lot of that. You know, we do know that languages have streamlined. You know, the general tendency of a language is to be more complicated at the beginning and get simpler rather than, you know, the evolutionary idea of simple to complex. And I mean, we can see it with English. English is becoming simpler and being stripped down, you know, and simpler in some ways and more complicated in other ways, you might say. In other words, languages tend to rely more upon habits rather than forms and rather than, you know, paradigms. And so that's where you get all these exceptions, and you get, you know, in Greek we get some verbs that are deponent or they have no forms here because they just quit using them and that kind of thing. So it makes it a little bit more troublesome in one respect, but it's more habit-oriented, more rather than concept-oriented. It's kind of interesting, that whole philosophy of that might be worthy of consideration too. It's just if the language were given as an entity by God supernaturally at Babel, and then as men spread out and so forth, things begin to change and simplify and so forth. And language changes, of course, with the culture, with the kind of things that people are doing and the kind of gods that they're worshiping and kind of government that they have and so forth is going to affect how they talk. Yes, Steve?
Well, I just simpler for the natives, more complicated.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, simpler for the people who are learning, you know, grow up with it and are not learning it the way we're having to learn it. But it makes it more complicated this way. If everything was, you know, is ironclad as it started out, perhaps, it'd be a lot simpler. Okay, that is an interesting point, though, from an evolutionary standpoint. Why should it be that we should see evidence of simplification in languages, and we're not seeing any evidence of going the opposite direction? You know,
separate the different groups of people more and more too.
Mm-hmm.
Read their languages.
Sure. Yeah, that's what you do see too. When you get people isolated and they start, you know, talking one among another and so forth, you get in America, of course, we've got, even in this country, it's very young, but we've got distinctive dialects for different parts of the country, you know, in a nation that's only a couple hundred years old. It's quite interesting. Okay, Tony.
One thing I noticed too, this seems to be a general rule. But when trying to translate from Greek into English, the grammar and the context tend to try to apply this one word equivalent, you know, like by or something,
mm-hmm.
rather than portray the full concept behind the grammar structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me like, you know, thinking about Schreiber and a lot of the things that he does, not very long
after
he brings across the idea without ever translate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing I want you to, you know, we don't want to become elitist here and so forth, but within our group we can confess freely that there's something that you can get from grammar you can't get any other way. And it's not even knowing the rules of grammar. You can still be in trouble just knowing the rules of grammar without really getting into it. And I think the thing that I want to emphasize most of all is being within, plunging ourselves into Greek and understanding the thought from the Greek, and then asking ourselves, how am I going to put this in English, rather than always being locked in English. And you find this change taking place, and this is one of the reasons for going through the translations in class like this together and thinking about them together and so forth, is to begin to make that transition so that we're moving into the realm of Greek and we're looking at the Greek construction and we're sensing, I know what this is saying, you know, because I'm looking at it from the context of all the other ways that the Greek expresses things, not saying, well, this preposition means such and such in English, and then we pull it over to English, and then we think in English of what it means, but think what it means in Greek, and then and then come to the English. And that's not an easy thing to tell anybody how to do. It has to come by experience. It has to come by experience with the language. And that's what we're trying and attempting to do. That way, in your sermons or in your exegesis in the future, you are going to be able to accurately portray the sense of the Greek. And the people you're ministering to may not even know that that's what you're doing. They don't know enough about the subject to know that. But you have a responsibility before God to be accurate. And this is one of the most important ways that I know of to attain that goal.
Also, it would not be
blatant. Yeah.
Not make it look like a dry Bible study.
Yeah, that's right. That's what a lot of these translations that are expanded translations are attempting to do. And there's a definite place for them. Of course, as soon as you do that, you open yourself up to some interpretation values of the authors. But Weiss and who's the other one that's amplified? Yeah. I was trying to think of, seems like there was another one too. But those are real useful if you know how to use them. And but if you've got this kind of knowledge of Greek and so forth, you probably won't even need those. You can just do the exegesis right from the text. Okay, let's go back to our reading then and resume our quest to begin to think in Greek. Yes?
Just possibility on this, when we looked at the adverbial accusative.
Uh-huh.
They used dorian. I looked up the time used. It is used a few times.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's used, well, they listed as dorian and then dorian.
Uh-huh.
And when it's listed as dorian, which is the accusative case,
mm-hmm.
every one of those instances is an utterance.
Okay.
And when it's listed as doria, every one of the accusative cases
is articulate.
Is articulate.
Okay. Okay, so that would serve them a basis to make a distinction there.
There's also a word, doron, which would I think it's probably neuter, although you know it's accusative again.
Mm-hmm.
It's being lifted that way, but the plural I found was neuter, so it may be a neuter idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's translated as gift.
Gift, no gifts. Okay,
so
I'm familiar with that one. And what do they give for the trans? They just give free gift for the other one, for Dorea?
No, they just give it as gift.
Okay.
Yeah, every time it's translated, it's gift.
Okay.
Whereas everywhere else, it's freely or without the cause, I think, or for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Any related verbs?
Doreo.
Okay. And it's just a gift.
It's only used three times.
Oh, okay.
Then there's a third one, too, Dorema.
Uh-huh.
Which is, yeah,
another
noun.
So.
Okay. It sounds to me like from that it's an English classification that they've done to turn it into an adverb.
Mm-hmm.
Because whenever it's used in an adverb, they call it an adverb.
It stands, I looked, just real briefly, I'd have to look at it more carefully, but it seems that it stood out in each sentence as being, it's just kind of standing there.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily so much the subject.
In other words, the context of the sentences weren't talking really about a gift that was given,
right.
but it was talking about a manner in which an action is performed.
And then, in Revelation at the end, it's got a take of the water of life.
Mm-hmm.
And those are that the water of life is both
mm-hmm.
those are also genitive. And then at the very end of the sentence, it says dorian, gift or
right.
So.
Even so, you know, I think Glenn's still got a point as far as that's the way we think in English.
Mm-hmm.
And to the Greek, he may not really be perceiving that construction as any different than any other accusative. It's just that that's the picture that they've got. In other words, they're thinking, you know, of this thing as a gift. And, you know, and that very well may be the case, too. We're always dealing with this problem of coming over to English and saying, how would we say this in English? And it's really hard to extricate ourselves from that. Okay, John chapter 2 is where we left off. I think we'll continue with chapter 2 for a little while longer here, maybe through chapter 3, where we start skipping around some more. And we might even take special requests later on, you know, portions of scripture that you'd like to get into. There's certain ones I definitely want to get into. But John chapter 2, since the Greek is relatively simple in John, this is where we like to start. Verse 20, I think, is where we left off. I don't know if we actually read that, or...
Yeah.
Okay, 46 years, okay, we did read that. So 21 is the next verse, and maybe John will start with you since you're...
Well, maybe.
All right? Maybe. We'll find out. When did you get started?
I'm really
Yeah.
The king of the elegant, Harry to Nau, to Somatos, out to.
Okay.
Short.
Yeah. Should be able to get that one.
But this he said about the temple of his body.
Okay. Yes.
I always had a question on this verse.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm taking Janet, Peri to Nau, Somatos, Autu. I can see that it's, you know, that Autu is describing the body, you know, the body.
Right. Yes.
But I, the way they never translated it as like Peri describing both the temple and the body, but the temple and the body describing the temple. And I always try to, you know, I always somehow saw that it was saying, you know, concerning the temple, concerning the body of him.
Okay. You'd be taking that as two appositional genitive constructions. Yeah, concerning the temple, that is concerning the body of him. You almost have got that idea. Well, you see what's happening here is... let me just ask this question. Remember those subcategories of genitive that we looked at, various types of genitives? How would you say that this phrase, tu somatos autu, relates to tu nau in that sense? Which one of those genitive applications? At least the way it's being translated in King James, the temple of his body. Yeah, appositional. Genitive of apposition, or genitive and apposition, appositional genitive. In other words, the temple which is his body, that is his body. Concerning the temple, which is his body, or you could, like you said, huh?
They use that as an example.
Oh, they have it there. Okay, good. Well, see, what you were saying, Glenn, is about the same thing in a way, because you're saying concerning the temple, that is the body of him. That's basically, in other words, what you're saying is the peri is governing both to Nau and to Somatos. You know, so like, is concerning the temple, concerning the body of him. And in effect, what that is doing is drawing equivalence between temple and body. It's putting them together. It's putting them in apposition. So
the temple of his body, like within the center of his body, there's a temple.
Yes,
so.
Or the temple that comes from his body, the temple possessed by his body, so forth. Those are, in other words, looking at the other possible genitives. The rest of them don't seem to fit the tenor, the context, and the meanings. In other words, temples don't come from people's bodies, you know, and you can't take it ablative or something, or ablative of source or origin or something like that, unless Jesus, you know, physical body was the, you know, if unless, you know, I suppose in some weird esoteric statement of in somebody's science fiction novel or something, you might see a construction like that, but in general, in the context of this, I think your options are really whittled down here. It wouldn't be. In a way, it is. It's functioning pretty much in the same sense. It's got the more idea of an appositional. Double accusative can sometimes be that way just because the verb happens to take two different kinds of limitations on its action, and not necessarily in apposition to each other. But this has got more of that appositional sense to it. Okay, we stay concerning the temple of his body. Any other questions? Okay, verse 22, Jim. Okay.
Therefore, when he raised...
Okay, this would be passive, so he was raised.
He was raised. Out from dead ones?
Yes, out from the dead ones, yeah, exactly. Raised out from the dead ones. From dead ones, yeah.
His disciples remembered...
Right.
...that...
Mm-hmm.
And they believed the scripture,
in a way, yeah. This verb, epistule, takes a dative, if you want to think of it that way, yeah.
And the word which Jesus said.
Yes. Okay, and the word which Jesus said. Okay, good. When therefore he was raised up out of the dead ones, his disciples remembered that he was saying this thing. It's actually an imperfect form, so it's got this progressive aspect. They remember that he was saying this thing, and they believed the scripture and the word which he said, which Jesus had said. Mm-hmm.
Well, I really got this on my brain now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you equate poem to one thing that tegraphe singular and to logo singular are both describing? Or is it, you commonly think the scripture and the word that Jesus said.
Yes.
But it's like, can you take it from both referring to the same thing?
Referring to the same thing?
The scripture and the word. This one that Jesus said.
Yeah. There are some instances where this gets a little fuzzy. There could be some times in which you might see a plural form in the pronoun if you were really trying to talk about two different entities and that it both apply to both. The singular could be either one of two things. It could just be referring back up to to logo, the immediate one there. He believed the scripture and the word which he had said. But I've seen enough constructions where it's a little bit ambiguous. It possibly could refer to, in other words, if the two things are describing one and the same thing, and especially if you had Granville Sharps, we don't have that here, but suppose you had Granville Sharps, then it might be more appropriate. That thing could refer to both of them at the same time, because they're both the same thing. In this case, you don't have Granville Sharps, so I would probably be more inclined to take this as a reference to to logo. In other words, you certainly could not prove from this construction that te graphe was something that Jesus had said. In other words, you couldn't apply that last phrase, which Jesus had said, to te graphe. You could apply it quite clearly to to logo. And the other would be a highly debatable thing. Probably not, but possibly in some unusual circumstances. Yes?
Yeah, I got two questions. First of all, would it work if you eliminated the chi, and then you had those in application, te graphe and to logo?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it would make it easier to see that, but I still don't think it would prove it. In other words, you can't really prove the point there. You could just say you could make the phrase te graphe in apposition to to logo hon epon ho Jesus. That whole phrase is now in apposition to this. Yeah. Right.
Second question is, the example of Granville Sharp's rule is, you have the article and then the two nouns.
Mm-hmm.
Both nouns are always in the same
case. Well, no, just gender. Same. Yeah, but
so here you've got two genders. How would you, if you took to logo, could you have it with the and stuck the two together?
You probably would never see that. I don't think it's ever seen. The reason why they don't even have to mention gender usually is because these Granville Sharps is dealing with nouns of personal reference, not with inanimate things. So in other words, you're talking about the Savior and the Lord or something like that, and they're all going to be masculine. Or if it's a woman, everything would be feminine. So I think that thing kind of takes care of itself by the qualification that we're referring to personal reference. But we will, by the way, we're going to get into Granville Sharps in far greater depth than you do in the Unfolding Rev class, because we're going to look at there's a lot of rules. It's not just one simple rule. That's the one we've focused on because of what we're wanting to look at, but there's a number of subcategories and so forth, so that's coming up before too long. I think I'm going to wait till after we discuss the article first, and then we'll get into Granville Sharps.
Does that mean that Granville Sharps won't work if the two nouns are different genders?
Well, probably not. In other words, Granville Sharps is an observation that's made with reference to a certain class of things. And so we can't really apply it as a rule in these other situations that are not satisfied or qualified. However, there are some instances in which you may see the same kind of thing functioning, but you're not on the same ground. You don't have the same set of precedents and so forth. So that's about the best I can say about that. I don't know if you want to say it just doesn't apply. I think what you really want to say is you need to look at those instances and try to set up some precedents among those instances with those qualifications to see what the bottom line is.